Chair, I believe we now move on to hear closing statements from each of the core participants, the first of which is Mr. Scorer of Slater and Gordon Solicitors. Thank you.
Chair and panel, on behalf of the survivors I represent, I want to thank the inquiry support staff for once again providing such a compassionate and professional service for my clients who came here to testify. And I also want to pass on our thanks to Ms. Scolding and Ms. McNeil for their very skilled presentation of the evidence. Most of my clients who came to this hearing have spent years in and out of different legal processes, for many years criminal processes and more recently civil processes. But this is the first opportunity that they have had in all of that time actually to testify, to give their accounts and to be properly heard. I know you will have seen very powerfully from their evidence the damage that abuse can do, the double injury done by church denial and cover-up, but also their dignity and the profound insights that they bring to this inquiry. And for my clients, the fact that senior figures in the Church of England have had to come to this inquiry and have had to undergo questioning about serious failings, this of itself gives confidence that these very important issues are being addressed at long last. So I want to put on record our thanks for that. Chair, what you've seen in the last 3 weeks of hearings has been aptly summarised by the Bishop of Buckingham. He described these hearings as a saga of religious exceptionalism, stupidity, incompetence, lying, dumping responsibility at every level, including the highest, and delusions of grandeur. And he concluded very bluntly with these words about the solution: bishops must be accountable, and this means not just to themselves. Chair, anyone who sat through the evidence would recognise that picture. And the question for you now is the question we started with. Can safeguarding be left to the church, or does it need independent oversight and enforcement? Chair, we say that one part of the answer to that question comes from looking at the history of events in Chichester. We certainly now have better safeguarding in the diocese, but what the history reveals is an unavoidable fact. The exposure of the scandals in Chichester and the changes to safeguarding which followed from them have come about overwhelmingly because of pressure and scrutiny from outside the church. At every turn in the Chichester saga, the church was reactive rather than proactive. It was reactive to pressure from survivors and reactive to pressure from the media. And what we had in Chichester was actually something fairly unique. We had an exceptionally determined and tenacious survivor campaigner in Phil Johnson, a man who simply wouldn't give up where most people would have given up. And we had a dedicated and tenacious journalist in Colin Campbell who wouldn't give up either. We know that these people made the difference. We've seen the internal Lambeth Palace and Chichester documents, and we've seen how often Phil Johnson features in them and how worried the church was about media coverage. So we know that if Phil Johnson and Colin Campbell hadn't been there and done what they did, events would have played out in a very different way, and quite possibly we wouldn't be here at all. And we also know that the very existence of this inquiry has forced the pace in terms of safeguarding. You saw a small example of the impact of the inquiry in real time during this hearing when Ms. Scolding found that local parish church where the vicar had been convicted for sexual offences and discovered that there was no safeguarding policy on the website. It was put to Bishop Warner, and next day there was a safeguarding policy on the website. It's a small example, but perhaps a telling one. And we heard on Wednesday how the church might now consider changing the language around the duty to report allegations, possibly changing the language of should to the language of must. Again, a change which is happening, if it does happen, under the spotlight of this inquiry after Mr. Frank's questioning on Tuesday. So when you're looking at recommendations for the future, the need for that external pressure and that external oversight has to be foremost in mind. From what we know about the prevalence of clerical sex abuse, you can be sure that every diocese in this country has a Roy Cotton, every diocese has a Colin Pritchard, and probably quite a few of them. Mr. Greenwood and I, who act for survivors right across the country, can tell you for certain that every diocese in this country has numbers of these perpetrators. These offenders are everywhere, as Elizabeth Hall said, not just in Chichester. But the reality that you also have to deal with is that not every diocese has a Phil Johnson, somebody prepared to sacrifice years of his life to exposing the truth. Most dioceses don't have that, and not every diocese has a Colin Campbell. Most don't. And indeed, not every diocese has a Colin Perkins. We've also heard a lot about the variations between dioceses when it comes to resourcing of safeguarding, when it comes to the skill of the personnel involved, and crucially, when it comes to the level of challenge that safeguarding advisers are prepared to bring to the church hierarchy. And this inquiry won't be here forever. As Adina Carmi said, what will be there to keep up the pressure for change after you've gone? So in future, there has to be something to make the church honest, to keep it that way, something that does not rely on uniquely determined individuals. Saying this does not mean that the church is incapable of any kind of organic change. Of course, some change has come from within and will continue to come from within. But the problem is the degree of change and the urgency of change. We've heard a lot from senior church leaders, particularly this week, about changing the culture. Bishop Hancock talked about changing hearts and minds. But the truth is that cultures don't change very rapidly. Bishop Benn and Bishop Reed have retired, of course, but they mentored a generation of priests, and the attitudes that they stand for have simply not gone away. And, Chair, as you commented on Wednesday, the events we heard about in these hearings are not historic, they are very recent. As Archbishop Welby said, there is still a level of misogyny in the church. There's still a very large gender imbalance. So the attitude you saw from Bishop Benn, the attitude that regarded the very mild-mannered Shirley Hosgood as aggressive or having a chip on her shoulder because she dared to question him, that attitude is still going to be there. And actually, when Archbishop Welby talked about cultural change, what was striking, I thought, was his impotence, or at least the serious limitations on his power. He can't direct his bishops. He can't change what happens in theological colleges where culture is implanted. He can't change the very muddled and conflicted attitude to homosexuality in the church, not just because of the wider Anglican communion and those issues, but because, to be honest, he himself believes that homosexuality is a sin. Of course, it's good to hear the church talk about a theology of safeguarding, but the reality is that those sorts of things take years, if not decades, to bear fruit in terms of changing behaviour. So there's much talk about cultural change, but few real levers to bring it about. We heard about all the structural problems in the church. We heard about the autonomy of dioceses. We heard about flaws in the CDM. We heard from many witnesses about how cumbersome and slow the CDM is and how unfit for purpose it is in safeguarding terms. But even at this hearing, there was a lack of data about the operation of the CDM, despite this hearing being in the pipeline for 3 years. Bishop Hancock, the lead safeguarding bishop, was unable to say whether anyone has ever been disciplined for failure to have due regard. I found that a surprising answer from the lead safeguarding bishop, but I also know him to be an extremely conscientious individual, and I'm sure that uncertainty reflects the structural obstacles that he has to work within and the diocesan autonomy that he has to deal with. As Adina Carmi said, church structure should adapt to the needs of safeguarding, but the reality is the church is fiddling around a structure which is fundamentally unsound. And you saw Graham Tilby's reluctance, I think, perhaps understandable reluctance given his role, but reluctance nonetheless to acknowledge that fundamental reality. Archbishop Welby talked a lot about training and trying to build a new theology. But what was very telling was that when he gave a secular example of cultural change, he talked about drink driving and how that was tackled. He was actually talking about something that was tackled not mainly through training and education, although those were important. He was talking about something that was tackled through the law, by tougher laws and stronger enforcement of the law. In other words, something that was tackled by the hard powers, which are exactly what he doesn't have. As he said, he has soft power if he has anything at all. So this church has deep-seated cultural and structural problems. But changing them, if they can be changed at all, will take generations. Safeguarding is far too urgent for that. So we say that we need something much more radical. And I return to the two changes that I talked about in my opening statement, independent oversight and mandatory reporting. On independent oversight, I want to be clear, I'm not talking about removing safeguarding from the church. they do need to own it. And the discussion in these hearings sometimes got sidetracked into the suggestion that safeguarding should be taken away from the dioceses and done by external people. Certainly, my view is that the church has to own that responsibility. What we're talking about here is independent oversight of safeguarding, and especially independent investigation of complaints about safeguarding failings and external enforcement of change where change is required. To use the Colin Perkins list, independence of audit, of victim redress, of response to whistleblowing, of discipline, of risk assessment, and of case review. All of those things, but genuinely independent, and more than that, the power to enforce any action needed over the heads of the bishops. I said in my opening that we can't have the church marking its own homework. I think in his evidence, Bishop Warner seemed to accept the force of that point. But where I think some in the church want to take you is the idea that somehow the Sky audits are going to constitute that independent oversight. Somehow the Sky audits will tick that box. But the fact is that they don't. The Sky audits are not frequent enough. They are time limited. They are done on terms set by the church. They don't involve survivor input, at least up until now. And of course, it's the church's decision whether they happen or not. None of that is a criticism of Sky. Idina Kami herself acknowledged the limitations of the audit process. But whether it's Sky or any other agency doing this oversight, there is a fundamental problem with external oversight where that oversight is designed and chosen by the organisation being overseen. It's a problem, I think, that was highlighted by the internal Lambeth Palace email that came up in evidence when we heard from Lord Williams. You saw Andrew Nunn, senior official at Lambeth Palace, made this rather revealing comment suggesting that Dame Butler Sloss was a good choice to do an external report because she was likely to be sympathetic. I think, as he put it to Bishop Hind, Bishop Hind knows her and thinks he and Bishop Benn will be safe in her hands. I don't suggest for a minute that Dame Butler Sloss was like that, but it was a revealing email because what it showed was that when the church was arranging an external oversight, there was a natural tendency to procure a form of oversight that is seen as likely to be sympathetic. This is why genuine independent oversight cannot be selected and organised on terms decided by the church. To extend my analogy, we can't have the church marking its own homework, but it equally will not be good enough and won't be effective if we end up with a situation where the homework is being marked by somebody else, but the church is still choosing the marker and the church still gets to decide the terms on which they're doing the marking. It has to be genuinely independent. And the other factor here, and Sir Roger Singleton rightly commented on this, is the need for oversight, particularly investigation of complaints, to have public confidence and especially survivor confidence. And I can tell you from all my conversations with survivors that this lack of survivor confidence in church institutions is a very serious problem. And frankly, if it was a problem before this hearing, it's not going to be any less of a problem after it. On most days during this hearing, there have been press reports about lack of survivor confidence in various cases. And there are certainly individuals at senior levels in the church who are liked and respected by survivors, but there is a deep-seated lack of survivor confidence in the institution as a whole, and particularly around the issue of involvement of insurers in some of these cases. Archbishop Welby said to us on Wednesday, "You have to keep coming back to what works for survivors." Well, the fact is that survivors have been consistently saying now, and saying for several years, that what works for survivors is independent oversight, independent handling of complaints, and independent redress. And actually, that's what many survivors thought was going to come with the Elliott review, but it certainly needs to happen now. I want to finish on the issue of mandatory reporting, which I mean, obviously, that knowledge or suspicions of abuse must be reported to the statutory authorities and with a sanction, crucially, for non-reporting. As I said in my opening, an independent body would certainly investigate where safeguarding has failed. And in certain circumstances, an independent oversight body might investigate allegations themselves. But obviously, complaints or allegations must be investigated initially by the statutory authorities. And, Chair, if one lesson comes out of this hearing, it is surely that as soon as the church knows about an allegation, it has to go to the statutory authorities. As soon as the allegation comes in, it has to go out. That need for a mandatory requirement to report is encapsulated, I think, very neatly in something Colin Perkins said in evidence. He talked about how in the, I think it was the Robert Coles case, a diocesan bishop, an area bishop, an archdeacon and two safeguarding advisers knew that he had admitted to some of the matters about which he had been questioned by the police, but none of them told the police. That simply cannot be allowed to happen again. And the need for mandatory reporting, I think, was also eloquently explained in this hearing by Alana Lawrence. It was put to her that the need for reporting could be instilled in people by education and training, rather than by legal compulsion. And in response, she made two points. She said that most of us like to believe that we would be whistleblowers, but the evidence is that most of us wouldn't be. Only a small percentage of us actually take the risk to be whistleblowers, unless there is a clear requirement to do so. And she went on to explain that the fundamental problem is a relational one. As she said, there's huge resistance, even when we do educate members of the congregation, to believe that their priest or any religious person could possibly cause harm. That view persists, and it persists because on this issue, people are not rational. Abuse of power is deeply relational, and the engagement with it is deeply relational. You struggle to get guidance to work because we're talking about relationships, not rational things, and good people can do the wrong thing in the face of an allegation. We heard exactly that sort of disbelief during these hearings and in the statement you've just heard. Colin Perkins talked about the Christopher Howarth case and how difficult people found it to accept that Howarth might be guilty. As Colin Perkins also explained, despite the evidence to the contrary, people frequently believe that risk diminishes with time. Indeed, even with apparently very highly educated people, we see basic misunderstandings being used as a justification for not taking action or for failing to report. We heard Nicholas Reed explain away a failure to report by claiming that there was insufficient evidence when the priest had actually admitted the components of the offence. We heard Lord Williams fall into the basic trap of misunderstanding what a caution is, and seemingly not understanding even now, and despite the case of Peter Ball being on his desk for over a decade and presumably preparing for this hearing, but he still didn't seem to appreciate that a caution involves an admission of guilt. This is a university professor and a former Archbishop of Canterbury, apparently still labouring under that misapprehension. So there are many misunderstandings that people have, and many people, as Alana Lawrence says, will simply not want to believe that a priest could commit a sexual offence against a child. So we say that you do need a clear mandatory obligation to report. That's the only way to address this, so that any information goes to people who are properly equipped to assess the significance of it. And the truth is that whatever the church says, we don't have that in the church at the moment. You've seen the mandate now analysis and the language of church policies, which were aptly described as flaccid. When Graham Tilby gave his evidence, he used the words should and must interchangeably in his answers, with the implication that they mean the same thing, but they don't mean the same thing. And in fact, the same ambiguity, I think, is reflected in the language of due regard. As people have said, why isn't the language simplified? Why doesn't it simply say must follow? Clarity is essential on these issues. Policies need clarity rather than managerial voodoo. And you heard Archbishop Welby say, in fact, that he didn't really understand the meaning of due regard. So here we have the head of the church, or the titular head of the church, saying that he actually doesn't really understand the meaning of words that are relied upon by the church to secure compliance. So what we have in the church is not clear and is not backed up by clear sanctions, either in church terms or, of course, in terms of the law of the land. But in any case, we say that whatever the church does, and we've already talked about the slowness of change through the synod, whatever the church does, reporting needs to be backed up by legal obligations in terms of the criminal law. And that is something that it is open to you to recommend, whatever the government has said recently. And Chair, when we look at the big changes that have happened in society over the past few decades, the changes that have protected vulnerable people, the changes that have saved lives, like it or not, the reality is that all of these changes have involved a degree of legal compulsion, whether we're talking about health and safety at work or protecting minorities from discrimination, or the wearing of seatbelts, or the smoking ban, or dealing with drink driving. Yes, these things were helped by education and training, but in the final analysis, what really made the difference and what embedded them in the culture and normalised them in the culture when they hadn't been there before was the fact of some legal compulsion, the fact that there was a legal consequence if you didn't do it. As Rupert Bercell said, we do it with money laundering, we do it with terrorism, we should do it with child abuse. And as Rupert Bercell and a number of other church witnesses said, we should also override the seal of the confessional. So, Chair, these are the changes that we believe that we need. The survivors that you have heard from in these hearings have lost years of their lives trying to challenge the church and get the church to change. And it would be a tragedy if another generation of survivors have to undergo that same experience. So we urge you to act and put in place effective measures to ensure that this never happens again. Thank you.